Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For those worried the economic recovery seems to be running out of gas, one guy who should know said today there is nothing to worry about. Of course, Alan Greenspan's been wrong before now, hasn't he? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 1st of July. If you can believe that, it is good to have you here. For those tracking the health of the American economy, today brought a veritable cornucopia of economic data. Sadly, none of it all that appetizing. Manufacturing growth has slowed. Pending home sales are down. And there are some worries that the June unemployment report tomorrow morning is going to be ugly. Which then leaves this gaping hole in the analysis. Is the recovery slip-sliding away, or is the economy just pausing to catch its breath? Jeff Horowitz reports.
What should we make of this raft of bad news? Into the void this morning stepped the one-time sage of Wall Street. Former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan was chatting over coffee on CNBC when he dropped a little economic bomb.
What we're looking at is an invisible wall, which essentially, as far as I can see, is a typical pause that occurs in an economic recovery.
Typical pause. That's typical Greenspan. Seems like such a boring phrase, but to economist Heather Boucher, them's fighting words.
That is ridiculous. I wouldn't say this is a typical recession, and I don't think that at this point in this particular nascent recovery, a pause is anything to not be very concerned about.
Boucher is senior economist with the Center for American Progress. Here's what's not typical, she says. Halfway through 2010, unemployment claims still aren't falling.
That is incredibly worrying, and that's not the kind of trend that we've seen in previous economic recoveries.
In Greenspan's corner, you'll find John Canale, economist with LPL Financial. Canale likes to call it a soft spot in the recovery, but typical pause, that'll work.
And it's not just happening this time, it happens at this point in every recovery.
Canale says midway through every recovery since the 70s, the economy goes into what he calls two-step forward, one-step back mode.
You usually see consumer confidence drop. You see various other measures of the economy kind of flatten out a little bit.
Canale says he puts the labor recovery right in the middle of previous recessions. You might even say it's typical. I'm Jeff Horowitz for Marketplace.
The House approved the financial reform bill last night. The Senate is going to wait until after the long holiday weekend to take its vote. But one key part of the other big reform bill that came out of Washington this year went into effect today. Temporary high-risk insurance pools for people who can't get insured because of pre-existing conditions. Some of those pools started taking applications today. But it's not yet clear how many people they will actually be able to help. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The health care reform law will make it illegal for insurers to refuse people because of pre-existing conditions, but that doesn't take effect until 2014. In the meantime, people who've been denied coverage can apply for insurance through the temporary pools. But the pools are really just a drop in the bucket. The new law budgets $5 billion for them. Austin Frecht is a health economist at Boston University. He says the government might have to limit enrollment so the money doesn't run out.
So if you start denying people, that doesn't look good. On the other hand, we're in a climate of fiscal belt tightening.
So it would be hard to persuade Congress to pony up more money. There are upwards of 40 million uninsured Americans. But the Congressional Budget Office says enrollment will have to be limited to about 200,000 people. Otherwise, the pools will be drained before 2014. Richard Popper is a deputy director at the Department of Health and Human Services. He says the department can make do by shifting money away from states with low enrollment.
We'll be monitoring the actual expenditures closely to reallocate between states if enrollment is lackluster in one state and in another state it's more robust.
The states might not like that too much. Linda Shepherd works for the Kansas Insurance Commissioner.
We would want to be able to have those funds that have been allocated to us available for those people here in Kansas.
The bottom line for the uninsured, apply for the pools early, before the money runs out. in Washington. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
I direct your attention now to Federal Reserve Rule E. Not that there's any reason you should know this, but that is the rule that covers electronic fund transfers. A new interpretation of that rule goes into effect today, which means that starting right now for new account holders and next month for the rest of us, if we try to buy something with our debit cards and we don't have enough money in the bank to cover it, the card is going to be rejected outright. No more $35 overdraft protection, unless you say you really want it. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Getting customers to risk a $35 penalty just so their card doesn't get rejected might seem like a hard sell. Some banks aren't even bothering. Bank of America is scrapping its overdraft protection altogether. Other banks are trying to scare customers into signing up with ads like these.
There are a few things more embarrassing than standing in line with your purchases all bagged up and being told your card has been declined.
The ads seem to be working. Estimates say nearly a third of bank customers have opted in to overdraft protection. Leslie Parrish is with the Center for Responsible Lending.
What really matters is who's opting in. Is it that very profitable group of customers that overdraw their account frequently? Unfortunately, those are the most financially vulnerable customers.
Parrish says it's too early to tell, but in the past, roughly 10% of customers generated nearly all of the $20 billion worth of overdraft fees banks took in every year. Bank consultant Mike Mebb says the banks that are doing the best at signing people up are stressing overdraft protection as a safeguard.
Those who are viewing this regulation as a positive for the consumer are getting an incredibly high consent.
Greg Graham, a lawyer in Commerce City, Colorado, hasn't overdrawn his account in years, but he opted in to protect his credit score.
The last thing we would want to have happen is to have a bill be unpaid simply because we don't have any overdraft protection.
Consultant Mike Mebb says many banks are trying to make overdrafts seem less predatory by lowering overdraft fees and offering to alert customers when their balances get low. That was part of why New Yorker Jennifer Visna, who recently lost her job, opted into overdraft protection for her Chase account.
I don't want to run out of money. I don't want to be somewhere and all of a sudden my debit card doesn't work and I don't have any cash.
Visna signed up for a text message alert that lets her know when her account dips below $150. She's overdrawn before and probably will again, but what's important to her is that her card works when she needs it to. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Traders made a long, slow climb back to almost break even today on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The euro had a real nice day on the foreign exchange markets. European banks seem to be at least a bit stronger than anybody had thought. The German economy is showing some surprising strength, too, so German policymakers are cautiously optimistic that the worst of the financial crisis is behind them. But with an austerity budget yet to take full effect, the average person in Germany isn't feeling quite as good, as Kyle James reports now from Berlin.
In Berlin's main park on a recent Sunday afternoon, the sun was shining and the big game was about to begin. Germany playing England for a spot in the World Cup quarterfinals. Enjoying a pregame beer, tourist Andy Markvart shares the general good mood.
It's a beautiful feeling here, and the weather is good, the people are friendly.
But the high spirits take a dive when he's asked about two recent developments on the economic front, a huge bailout to Greece, and a new budget-cutting plan Berlin recently unveiled. Markvart says the average German is being squeezed again, asked to cough up cash for mistakes others have made.
We pay for them every time. And forever. Because if they go in the pockets of the Germans and they grab all the money.
He objects to Germany paying the biggest part of a rescue package arranged for Greece earlier this year. The European Union and the International Monetary Fund deal gave Athens a $134 billion loan. And in early June, the package of budget cuts announced by the government was the biggest since World War II. The measures aim to bring down the deficit, but they'll mostly hit working people and the poor. It all worries Michael Burkhardt from Cologne.
Other countries play a little more fast and loose with their money, and it's a shame that we have to jump in for them. So Greece is the first. But what's going to happen to Portugal, Spain, and the others? We Germans can't be expected to come to the rescue of all of them.
He and many others here feel Germany is being punished for keeping its economic house in order. Germans save more than 10% of their income, compared to about 1% for Americans. And Berlin has traditionally kept its spending and its deficits under control, something Athens and Madrid did not. Erwin Collier of Berlin's Free University says all that being responsible has its price.
Is Germany doomed to be the good Euro-Samaritan? And for the foreseeable future, this is a role for Germany to play. Germany is carrying a lot of the burden.
That burden became too much for some in mid-June. Thousands from left-wing groups in Berlin and Stuttgart protested the new austerity plan. Wolfgang Edman came to Berlin from Hamburg to show his displeasure.
The anger is really big, but the fear is also very, very big. So there could be a development of perhaps many demonstrations.
But then silence. No more demonstrations, no widespread uprising, only some grumbling. If this were France, a new guillotine might be going up about now. Germany's different, says Klaus Abel of the major German union IG Metall.
Lenin once said that revolution would never happen in Germany, because if the Germans wanted to storm a railway station, they'd buy a train ticket first. Germans tend to have a lot of faith in their institutions, but I think it would be good if people would get out there and get involved more.
But right now, the only thing that really seems to be stirring German passion is soccer. The German team's victory over big rival England sparked a surge of national pride. Talk about bread and circuses. Now, if Germany loses this weekend against Argentina, things might change. Oh, but then there are those 6 weeks of summer vacation Germans will need to take. So, possible protesting? That can wait until the fall. In Berlin, I'm Kyle James for Marketplace.
We mentioned high-risk insurance pools a little while ago. People who'd been denied health insurance because of pre-existing conditions will now have a chance to get it. That ought to mean fewer calls like these from the comedy sketch group Nice Kitchen at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater.
Hi, Mr. Johnson. This is Carol. How may I assist your call?
Hi. I wanted to ask why my application was denied for health insurance.
Well, sir, people with pre-existing conditions unfortunately have a harder time acquiring health care.
What pre-existing condition?
I'm sorry, sir, but obesity is a pre-existing condition. People with obesity have a much higher rate of heart failure and diabetes.
That is ridiculous. I'm 5 pounds overweight.
I'm sorry, sir. Can I put you on hold for a second? Hi, this is Carol. How may I assist your call?
I was just wondering why my health care premium is so insanely high.
Okay, let me see your file here. Well, Mr. Andrews, you have hay fever, and unfortunately we charge higher premiums to people with pre-existing conditions.
What? Allergies are a pre-existing condition?
Well, people with hay fever are susceptible to many respiratory diseases.
This is crazy. I would like to talk to your manager.
Yes, sir. I'll transfer you immediately. Hold, please. Hi, this is Carol. How may I assist you today?
Hi, I was denied my health care coverage. It says for a pre-existing condition.
Yes, ma'am, you were.
I don't understand. I'm in perfect health, and no diseases run in my family. In fact, I was a professional athlete in my early 20s, and I have never smoked or had a drink in my entire life.
Yes, ma'am, but you live in North Carolina. And you're a woman.
So?
Current statistics show that females are more likely to be victims of domestic violence. And in North Carolina, domestic violence, unfortunately, is considered a pre-existing condition.
I'm not even in a relationship. Are you serious?
Yes, ma'am. Oh, can you hold for a minute? Hi, this is Carol. How may I assist your call?
Hi, I am a vampire. I am immortal. This means I cannot die. I just want to purchase cheaper blood so I don't go hungry and kill other people, making more vampires. Can I please get health insurance?
Well, let me see here. Vampires. V-A-M-P. Huh. Let me see. Oh! Well, lucky for you, being dead is not a pre-existing health condition. Hooray! We'll be mailing you an application in 5 to 7 business days.
I want to suck your blood.
That's the nicest thing anyone said to me all day.
Nice Kitchen is Ann Gregory, Ann Maddox, Brian Moran, Joe Saunders, and Mike Truesdale. There are more Upright Citizens Brigade sketches on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, the cell phone wars.
You know, there's three big national competitors, and we benchmark ourselves and compare rate plans and devices against those three all the time.
That's Sprint CEO Dan Hesse coming up, but first, let's do the numbers. Oh, the Dow Industrials fell another 41 points today. That is 0.4%, finished at 9,732. The NASDAQ shaved off 7 points, about a third of 1%, finished at 2101. The S&P 500 gave back 3 points, about a third of a percent, ended the day at 1,027. Financials were hit pretty hard today. Bank of America dropped nearly 2.5%. Wells Fargo lost more than 1.75%. J.P. Morgan Chase ended the day down 1.33%. KB Home didn't feel too welcome, crumbling more than 1.75%. Today, the air went out of the balloon for toymaker Hasbro, too. Shares there collapsed almost 0.67%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note edged up to 2.95%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com/market. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. President Obama and Vice President Biden attend funeral services for their former colleague, Senator Robert Byrd from West Virginia. The Labor Department reports on unemployment data for the month of June. And justice for all, 46 years ago, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law. I'm Cormac O'Connor.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and there is a certain something about Southern California. There has been for a long time now. So today on our summer book series, commentator Gustavo Arellano and a historical look at popular perceptions of this part of the country.
It's almost 65 years old, yet Southern California, an island on the land, is far from dated. In fact, it remains the best guidebook to our twisted, mysterious paradise ever written, and one I will read for the fifth time this summer. Its author, Carrie McWilliams, is best known nationally as a longtime editor of The Nation magazine. But as a young man, McWilliams was a crusading journalist in California, and Southern California, the book, was a regional memoir of sorts, written just a couple of years before he left for the East Coast. In the book, McWilliams describes in marvelous prose a Southern California that remains, even decades after his writings. The numerous religious movements, the outstanding talent of boosters to self-mythologize, the skeletons in our closets scratching to get out, and our eternal distrust of Mexicans. The observations make the title of his biography, American Prophet, more fact than bombast. One passage in particular rings truer now than ever before. In a chapter on Southern California's massive citrus industry, he recalled how the power structure in Orange County reacted when Mexican orange pickers tried to unionize. Roundups, deportations, public demonizing. Sound familiar? McWilliams wrote he was astonished, quote, in discovering how quickly social power could crystallize into an expression of arrogant brutality in these lovely, seemingly placid, outwardly Christian communities, end quote. Southern California, an island on the land, encapsulates our legendary sunshine. Its beauty, its danger, its everything.
Gustavo Arellano writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. Tell us what you're reading this summer. Go ahead and post those recommendations and reviews in a comment on our website. It's marketplace.org. What do you do if you're a distant third in one of the most dynamic parts of the technology industry? That's the question Sprint has been wrestling with since it merged with Nextel back in 2005. You could say that deal turned out to be one giant dropped call after another. The new company struggled with network problems and customer service complaints. It lost millions of customers and billions of dollars. So 2.5 years ago, a guy who used to run AT&T Wireless was hired to turn things around.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Sprint CEO Dan Hesse. He is the face of the company, quite literally. You've probably seen him in the company's television ads. When we talked in New York on Monday, I asked him how he's going to get all those lost customers and their lost dollars back.
Well, there's a number of things that play into a customer's decision of either staying or leaving. Number one is who has the device or phone that I really want. Part of it also, and increasingly, is the family. I might love my Sprint phone, but there's one person in the family that just maybe has to have the iPhone, and so the whole family goes over, if I use that as an example. Sure. What I'm hoping is one person in the family has to have an Evo.
About this whiz-bang new phone you guys have, this is now supposed to be the only 4G phone in the world, the Evo by HTC. Kind of seems like you're betting on this one to bring back those iPhone users and everybody who got away.
Well, we hope so. And it is important to be on the leading edge. And we think that 4G, anybody who wants mobile video.
You have one right here. Let's pull it up.
Yeah.
We'll do a little show and tell.
Boy, this thing does so much, I don't know where to start.
No, pick one. I mean, when you pick this thing up and play with it, what do you do?
I typically do email. So there's, you know, I go there, and there's my email. I go out of that. I go to my messages, which are my text messages.
And it's a nice, crisp screen, and it's, you know, big and fancy and all that.
I hit this button. I go to my tons of applications, and they have so many. My favorite probably is Google Goggles.
What is? I don't know what Google
Goggles
is.
Where I take a picture of anything, like a wine label, and it'll automatically come back with all the search results.
So what all this tells me is, I mean, you're hauling around really nice new smartphones.
Yes.
It tells me that here's a guy who runs a major wireless network company. In a lot of ways, it's all about the toys. It's all about the gizmos on the other end.
It's getting more and more that way.
Yeah.
Each year, and it's actually one of the challenges for the for the industry, because these are heavily subsidized. The average user doesn't know that these are $500 and $600 phones. They think they're $100 and $200 phones, and that's why they say, "Well, why do I have to sign a 2-year contract?" Well, it's because you're making a down payment. You're not really buying the phone. You're making a down payment on the phone.
So, if Steve Jobs came to you tomorrow and said, "Dan, when our contract with AT&T expires in a couple of years, we would like you to have the iPhone contract," how long would it take you to jump on that deal?
Well, I'd want to see what the deal was. But the answer is, of course, it's a great device, and I would be very interested. But, you know, everything has a cost and a price.
Seems that everybody in this country over the age of, like, 11 and a half has a cell phone, and there's not so much room to grow in the actual cell phone part of the mobile phone market. How do you guys grow then? I mean, where's the growth opportunity for you if you can't get more cell phones into people's hands?
Well, penetration in the United States right now is 91%, which is high. And it's a very good question. You know, how do you grow? First, if you just look at the phone piece of the business, the prepaid market is growing very rapidly. That's people who don't have a phone. Part of it is because if your credit score isn't high enough, we won't sell you a phone. Unless you go prepaid, because again, basically we're a bank when you come in and sign a 2-year contract.
You're financing that phone.
We're financing the phone. Then there's what I call the inanimate objects that will start to carry wireless chips, what we call machine-to-machine, meters, vending machines. You can go right down the list. Cars will have wireless chips where they're monitored all the time, and that'll give us revenue on our network. So there'll be many more devices that are connected to the wireless network than there are people. So the concept of penetration is how many people have a cell phone won't be as important, because it could be, penetration could be 300%, 400% in terms of the number of devices that are connected to the mobile network, more than just their, what we would call a phone, although they're hardly a phone anymore.
Yeah, no, I know. When you guys have your Monday morning ops meetings, when you get together and
Monday talk afternoon.
Ops, Monday afternoon, not morning? All right, you're not a morning guy. How frequently do the phrases AT&T and Verizon come up? Do you think actively about the leaders in the field?
Oh, absolutely, all the time. And T-Mobile would be the other third major competitor. So our, you know, there's three big national competitors, and we benchmark ourselves and compare rate plans and devices against those three all the time.
All right, well, given that then, since the gap between you and the industry leaders is so large, is catching up something you think about, or are you trying to, you know, keep the pace?
Well, you know, I just look at having a good, successful, viable, growing company that does well for our shareholders. So is Apple one of the biggest cell phone makers in the world? No. You know, number one in computers? No. But I think their shareholders have done pretty darn well. You don't have to be a RIM, you know, BlackBerry. They're not one of the big monster guys. They're not, you know, they're not one of the top three, but they're a very profitable, growing company. So people ask me, you know, boy, Sprint at you're only $36 billion in revenues. You know, can you big enough to make it? I think so. We're, you know, like in the, I think we're number 57 on the Fortune 500 list. We're roughly half the size of AT&T and Verizon. Do I think it's likely in the near future that we're going to catch them in size? No. But, you know, if I can keep improving our financial performance, I'll have satisfied shareholders and employees.
Dan Hesse from Sprint, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Kai. It's been a pleasure.
There is much more of my interview with Dan Hesse on our website. And while I've got you, a quick note about another interview coming up next week. I'll be talking to Biz Stone and Evan Williams on Thursday. They are the guys who started Twitter. So in the tradition of social media, send along whatever questions you would like to ask. Maybe one or two apiece, not whatever questions. You can respond to my Twitter feed. It's at Kai Rizdahl is the handle. Or you can post those questions on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, pension funds have been in the news quite a bit lately. A lot of them are running out of money, both public sector and private company pensions. The international beverage conglomerate Diageo has a $1 billion hole in its pension obligations, so it's getting creative. The company is going to be transferring ownership of millions of barrels of whiskey to its pensioners. Actually, it's not technically whiskey just yet. Freshly distilled spirits, apparently, have to age 3 years before they can actually be called whiskey. But the booze will eventually give the fund a steady stream of Johnny Walker that it can sell off and pay pensions with, which sounds like a pretty neat idea. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday. Today, the Dow lost 41 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ off 7 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 dipped 2 points. We'll call that about 0.25%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, we will take a look back at the week with our weekly wrap regulars, and we'll hear the last of our summer book recommendations, too. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.